From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The recent polar vortex of 2019 was so severe that the city of Chicago was actually colder than the North Pole, Antarctica, and Alaska. Just months earlier, California was burning. We have entered the topsy-turvy world of unpredictable weather patterns that are a predictable outcome of climate change. We're at a tipping point, and yet our political leaders boast of oil and gas dominance and the stripping away of even modest regulations on greenhouse gas emissions. We turn today to Joshua Frank, managing editor of Counterpunch. He's the co-author with Jeffrey Sinclair of the new book called The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink. Welcome to the program, Joshua.
Thanks for having me back.
So the book is written almost in a sort of poetic way, I noticed. You and your co-author, Jeffrey Sinclair, spend a lot of time describing the things that you love about our planet, about our country, about the Western United States, and some of the dire situations facing it. Give me a sense of how you approached this book and what your goal was, because there have been a lot of books written on climate change.
Yeah, you know, we looked at it as sort of a firsthand take on what's happening to our planet instead of this broader esoteric thing called, you know, climate disaster or whatever you want to call it, right? We know the numbers, we know that it's heating up, we know oceans are rising, we know glaciers are melting, but what does that feel like firsthand to those of us that are on the front lines of it? And everybody's on the front lines no matter where you live. Things are changing, the climate's changing, weather and patterns are changing, and people know what's going on. So we wanted to get out there and see firsthand how it's experienced, you know, how people are experiencing it, whether it's, you know, drought, farmers dealing with drought, whether it's communities that have been ravaged by wildfires, whether it's people that are like Jeff and I that like to get out into nature and are seeing the firsthand effects of our dying forests from, I know, pine bark needle, the beetles that are eating up our forests throughout the West, and of course the glaciers that are melting and so on. So we really wanted to get out there firsthand and sort of explore on the ground what's happening. And instead of sort of sitting back from a scientific point of view, where I think things can get a little bit out of hand because we don't really, all of us don't really know what's going on.
Yet those graphs showing average, you know, global warming of the planet increasing are quite compelling. But do you feel that those people who are more in touch with nature, you know, who like to get out more, who like to hike more, who maybe work in an environment that involves them being out in nature, farmers or forest rangers, have, or even just, you know, people who like to take their kids on hikes, have a more intuitive sense that something is deeply wrong, particularly, you know, those of who've been around a lot and who've been able to witness the change? The planet changes pretty slowly, and it seems as though what we're witnessing now is an artificially created change.
Sure. You know, it doesn't take much. I mean, we've been out even close to where you and I live, out into Riverside County, talk to people, farmers out in that area, and they've recognized these changes that have been happening so rapidly in their case because of the severe drought and then rain and then drought that California has been experiencing, and their orchards are dying. So, you know, this is something that people all over the planet are experiencing in different ways. But of course, those of us that are even in our own backyards, right, that we may be seeing these climate changes. I surf. I know that the ocean patterns are changing. I know the ocean temperatures are much different than they have been in the past. So you don't have to talk to anybody. It's not about political, where you land on the political spectrum. I really believe that more and more people are waking up to the fact that things are changing, where they're not all buying into Trump's rhetoric that the polar vortex has nothing to do with climate change.
Joshua, you have a chapter in your book about biomass. Burn a tree to save the planet? The crazy logic behind biomass. Tell us about this.
Well, we've seen a big, in order to talk about it, right, we have to talk about what's happened to our coal plants. And our coal plants across the country, a lot of them have closed down. A lot of them have been switched over to natural gas, all in this sort of rhetoric of green energy, right? And one of those changes also has to do with burning trees instead to produce energy, which is a very archaic form of energy production. And with that comes horrific environmental impacts. Yet it's still being billed as a green energy because it's sort of quote unquote renewable, right? Because you can grow trees and replant them. So it's like any other crop. But the effects of that, the impacts of that are really, really horrific. And so part of exploring, you know, energy production, the things that we looked at in the book are in a way trying to debunk the myth that certain things are considered green energy. I mean, I think most people understand fossil fuels are not a green energy. Natural gas, for example, has all sorts of problems. And it might be less impactful in some ways than coal, but it's a lesser evil isn't necessarily better. Biomass is one of those examples. Most of the trees that are being grown for biomass are genetically engineered, which has a host of problems. And then, of course, the air pollution that comes from burning trees. Burning wood is very, very toxic, and the particulate matter is very harmful for communities.
So there's the source of greenhouse gas emissions when we burn anything that actually spews things like carbon dioxide into the air. But then there's the impacts of that on our planet. All of those go hand in hand. You have the cause and the effect. And among the effects that are talked about a lot in the media are the impacts on glaciers. We heard recently about a study showing that a massive glacier in Antarctica has a giant city-sized cavity in the middle of it. It's melting faster than we thought it was, which will lead to rising sea levels. But is it it seems sometimes abstract to talk about these glaciers because those of us who live in countries like the U.S. don't actually get to see glaciers firsthand, do we? But then there's Glacier National Park that you write about in Montana.
Yeah. And I grew up, you know, going to Glacier National Park, and that wasn't that long ago. I don't want to age myself too much, but a few decades ago, I was exploring that as a kid. And going back there it's a stark difference. And Jeff St. Clair writes about it as well in his backyard in Oregon. The Mount Hood has glaciers that are receding as well. You know, we had a recent report that the glaciers in the Himalayas may be all gone by 2100. These are big esoteric things, but they're happening very rapidly, and it doesn't take much to see those changes. But now, how do those changes impact us and wildlife? Those are the things we also try to explore a little bit in the book.
You write about grizzly bears, also quintessentially American, a part of American wildlife. Here in California, where you and I are based, the grizzly bear, you know, is a familiar figure. Even if we don't personally get to see them in action, we know they're part of our environment. How is climate change impacting the grizzly?
Well, the grizzly in the lower 48 is primarily in Montana and Wyoming.
I see.
And those bears, of course, they used to be in California until they went extinct from human development.
Right. And, we're thinking of Big Bear Mountain where we once had bears.
But there used to be grizzlies roaming the coast of California, which is amazing to think about. It really wasn't even that long ago. But right now, most of the healthy grizzly populations are in Yellowstone Park area of Wyoming and Montana. And those bears are increasingly being impacted by climate change. The nuts that they eat on pine trees are starting to disappear as the temperatures go up. More of these pine bark beetles are infesting the forests. They're destroying some of this food source that the bears are used to. So bears aren't stupid, and they have a big range, and so they exit the park and they're looking for food. And in this case, you know, bears aren't aware of where those boundary lines are. So when they exit the park, it becomes a whole new bureaucratic system that's managing them. And so even recently, you know, in Wyoming, We're seeing bear hunts that are going to be happening. So they're being impacted on multiple fronts. They're being impacted because of their food source going away. And now, because of that, they're in search of food, so they're going outside of their protected boundaries, which is another consequence of climate change. And unfortunately, we do not have a current government doesn't really care much about the fate of the grizzly bear.
How have our governments, various governments, not just the Trump administration, but before them, before this, the Obama administration, been part of the problem? I mean, notwithstanding the dominance of the oil and gas industry, it is the job of the government, it is a job of our regulatory agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency to protect the public, to protect the planet. And of course, they've been failing over and over again, with, you know, some exceptions here and there, but they're just, they, you know, even Obama's attempt to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant didn't come early enough, didn't go far enough, and was eventually challenged in court. How deeply complicit has the U.S. government been in climate change?
Absolutely complicit. One thing I know, right now we have an administration that's blatantly anti-science, right? We've seen the EPA has essentially been gutted. Scientists and studies have been halted and scientists fired. And it's an all-out war on science within this current administration. But that doesn't mean Obama was all that much better. Well, the science might have been better, the policies weren't. We saw a huge increase in natural gas production. We saw CO2 emissions rise under Obama. They're rising again. Methane emissions, which are potentially more impactful in the immediate time frame, rose under Obama. So while the talk was a little bit tougher, obviously, than Trump on paper, and then what we've seen now is that his inaction really increased the CO2 emissions, not only in the U.S., but also globally. We became an exporter of oil and natural gas for the first time in decades. Obviously we saw the fracking boom happen under Obama in North Dakota. That fracking was actually fracking for oil. And we obviously usually think of fracking as natural gas, but in the case of North Dakota, it's oil. Fracking boomed across, you know, Texas for natural gas. This all happened under Obama, and it's continuing, of course, to happen under Trump. Now, Trump's taking it a step further and wants to open up our coasts to oil development all over, wants to open up ANWR in Alaska. So it's a continuation of a problem that's been going on for a very, very long time.
So we also have a deep sense of helplessness today, unfortunately, because there seems to be so much, the oil and gas industry seems to have so wholeheartedly controlled our political system that we just don't have the political will among our leadership to take the swift action that is needed. As your book suggests, Earth is on the brink. We are at a tipping point. We have such a small window to try to pull back from this precipice that we stand. It seems as though there's so much cause for hope, or is there? I mean, young people are fighting as hard as they can, but ultimately it's up to the rest of us to join them.
Sure. Yeah, you know, and I think we don't all have to be on the front lines of, for instance, the Standing Rock protests. And right now there's even more protests developing against a tar sands pipeline in Minnesota. We don't have to be on those front lines, but we can definitely support those actions. But even locally, where we live in our own communities, there's plenty that we can do. And it can be as simple as trying to buy as much of your produce locally, riding your bike and walking when you can. There's lots of little things that we can do that impact in the long run, our climate. But I think what you pointed out is correct. You know, I think it can seem very, very dire. But I think where Jeff and I, and in particular, where we see a lot of reason to keep fighting, is that there's plenty to keep fighting for. You know, just as we were talking about the grizzly bears, there's plenty to keep fighting for. Salmon, grizzlies, indigenous communities that are in areas where waters are rising in Alaska, or, you know, in the Pacific Ocean. These are things to continue working and fighting for, because if we can't put the brakes on climate change, the best we can do is adapt and try our best to preserve what is there to protect.
One of the things that you write about in your book is how things like militarism and war contribute to climate change. We don't often link those issues. Can you make that link?
Yeah, certainly. You're right. One of the things we often forget about is the impacts of what war is on our environment and our climate in particular. We, you know, especially even on the left, we don't talk about it. We talk about how it's impacting civilians, for instance, or migration of people or and those sorts of things. But often we forget what those impacts might be on the environment. For instance, when we write about in the book, the war in Afghanistan and what that's done to some of the mountain regions there, some of which we don't really even know the impacts of because we're not able to, you know, scientists aren't able to get in there to assess the problem. But they're bombing and have been bombing, you know, for now going on, what, how long has this war been going on, right? 18 years?
Yeah, nearly 18 years.
That they've been bombing areas where the snow leopard is in very critical habitat. We have no idea what that has done. Migratory birds in those areas, we have no idea what that has done. And this is just as aside from the Pentagon being one of the top polluters in the world as far as the amount of fossil fuels that our military burns. So war definitely is fueling climate catastrophe, and the impacts on the ground are ravaging for those places. You can imagine if our across the Midwest there was been bombed for 18 years, what that kind of impact would be. It's quite horrific.
Is capitalism incompatible with a safe planet? A lot of people have been making the links in recent years, most notably Naomi Klein's book about climate change, and you know the suggestion that we cannot keep continuing on our path with this economic growth model that is literally consuming the planet in the service of corporate profits. But others, you know, would like to believe we may be. Most importantly, corporate Democrats would like to think that capitalism can save the planet from climate change. The tech industry probably thinks it can as well. What are your views on this issue?
I certainly do not think capitalism can save our planet. I've seen no evidence of that. We've seen absolutely no examples of capitalism saving anything, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that socialism can either in certain contexts. I mean, there's certain systems that we can look at where socialism has been reliant on fossil fuel production. Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution was largely dependent on oil production, for example, and I would argue that wasn't exactly a sustainable model. And I think some of those ramifications of that we're seeing now in some ways. But nonetheless, I do think we need to reassess what we consume as individuals. I live very close to one of the largest port complexes in the entire country and world, in fact, the Long Beach and LA complex that is bringing in goods from all over the world. And most of those good goods are being trucked on a freeway, on train, to distribution centers that end up in stores across the country. And people are going there and purchasing products that are not made anywhere near them. And most of us don't think about what that impact has been on our planet just to get to where you can purchase it at your local store, your Walmart, your Gap, wherever you're getting your clothes, for example. And those are the systems that we need to challenge, and those are the ones that we can fight directly. It's definitely not a sustainable model for us to be eating products, for instance, or food that's grown in places like China. I couldn't believe it. Recently, I was at Whole Foods looking at some frozen produce, and I was startled that I saw some organic broccoli that was grown in China. That to me was just totally astounding. But it's
I recently found frozen cherries that were organic and grown in Turkey. So
right, yeah, and you might need cherries for a delicious dessert you're making, right? But and it's easy to not think about what that carbon footprint might have been for those cherries to get into your shopping cart.
Especially when we know we can grow cherries right here in the United States, but we have to wait for cherry season, and we've all sort of just become accustomed to wanting what we want at any time that we want because corporate America has spoiled us, and now we expect it. And then corporate America turns around and blames us for having those demands. So certainly we need a cultural shift, right?
Yeah, right. And so I don't think it's just a revolution in the system, which it was obviously needed. But before that can ever happen, we need to have a revolution in the way we think and how we perceive our system, right? So we have to challenge it directly before we can even think more broadly about how the system itself can change. And I am hopeful that especially the young generation now, I think, is starting to understand that. And we're seeing that with the Green New Deal, that this definitely doesn't go far enough, and it's still within the confines of capitalism. But without that conversation starter, you know, where would we be? You know, I've heard a lot of people in the Green Party, for example, the sort of originators, one of the originators of the Green New Deal, kind of moaning that it's now been adopted by some progressive Democrats. And I always just say, well, isn't that a good thing? Isn't that the point, is that we want this to go mainstream? And so, you know, I do see some hopeful signs. Of course, there's a lot to be done.
Right. We're seeing international action as well. And Joshua, I'd like to end with asking you to talk a little bit about how you see the rest of the world moving on climate change. There are, you know, we forget that there are people outside our borders who care about it, perhaps more than we do. Europe is light years ahead of the US, some European countries, in terms of adopting renewable energy. Climate activism is pretty strong in Europe as well. And there are many other parts of the world. Often we, you know, are pointed to China and India, these emerging economies, as being now the bigger perpetrators of greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. How do we put the struggle against climate change into an international context? Do you think that the world, much of the rest of the world, who remained in the Paris Accord, signed on to the Paris Accord, and now the U.S., of course, has backed off under Trump. Is the rest of the world doing better than we are?
I would say in large part, yes. You know, there's still, China has a lot of problems. India has a lot of problems. But I think within the confines of capitalism and the market, countries in Europe that might be prospering yet moving towards renewable energy are examples that other countries can follow, right? I mean, right now, those emerging countries that you talked about are following the U.S.'s old model in large part by using fossil fuels to fuel their economy. And that's not obviously a sustainable model. It's one that is harmful to their workers. It's one that's harmful to the environment and locally and more, you know, broadly. So those countries that are on the precipice of moving forward in eliminating coal, for example, moving towards solar energy and small wind power in some cases, is an example of what can be done and still have a prosperous, good life, right, with Medicare for all and other things. It doesn't necessarily mean just because we eliminate fossil fuels that we're going to start living, you know, in rock huts again. We can have there's certain things we certainly need to give up, but one of those things isn't sort of certain comforts that we've come to expect.
Joshua, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out the website for Counterpunch.
Counterpunch is online at counterpunch.org.
And we'll link to that from our website as well. Thank you so much and good luck with the book.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Joshua Frank is managing editor at Counterpunch, and we've been discussing the new book he co-authored with Jeffrey Sinclair called The Big Heat, Earth on the Brink. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.